Before getting to the topic of euthanasia, however, let me briefly talk about religious secular exchange more generally. And for those of you that were at the event last night, I hope you're not too annoyed to hear this again. As you probably know, in America we have both robust religious and robust secular discourses. And we both try to work things out in our public spheres. I come to these discussions specifically as a Christian ethicist, Catholic ethicist, who wants to speak on some of the most controversial issues in bioethics and ethics more generally. Some of my colleagues are very pessimistic about the possibility of such interaction, and with good reason. We are now more polarized in the United States than at any time since our Civil War. And divides between secular and religious folks play a large part in this polarization. But I'm actually more hopeful than many about this, especially given my recent interactions with Peter Singer, who helped teach Julian, though Julian is moving away from Singer's views at the moment, I think. I debated Peter and lectured in his classes at Princeton. Last year he came to my own doctoral bioethics seminar at Fordham and came to dinner with some of us afterwards. We planned a major international conference together at Princeton, trying to find new ways to think and speak about abortion. And next month he will join a panel at Fordham that I'm putting together, which puts him in conversation with a diverse group of Christian theologians to think differently about non-human animals. On the basis of these and other experiences, I want to argue that religious and secular discourse, something that is the overview of these two debates, can go much, much better if the following three things can happen. First, religious folks need to acknowledge the critique that often comes from secular folks, that our arguments rest on first principles for which we do not have arguments. They simply grab or claim us by some kind of authority. They are based on faith. Second, secular folks need to acknowledge the critique that often comes from theologians, that their arguments also rest on first principles for which they do not have arguments. They also simply grab or claim them by some sort of authority. Whether it is the utilitarian dogma that one counts as one and none more than one, or the supreme libertarian doctrine of personal freedom and autonomy, or even general claims about our capacity to recognize flourishing and well-being, these ideas come from a fundamental understanding of the good for which there simply cannot be arguments. They come from a narrative, a story, an intuition, or other a priori commitment. In short, they are also based on faith. Third, armed with the knowledge that both religious and secular folks have faith-based understandings of the good, we need to take the time in intellectual solidarity with each other to map out the places where we agree and where we disagree. We will often find, I believe, that the agreement is quite substantial, in particular because even in the secular West, I would argue that our understandings of the good are significantly indebted to the Abrahamic religions. This is especially a promising methodology, in my view anyway, when we can work to find similar ways to talk about flourishing and well-being. And Julie and I are working on a paper that we're trying to write together at the moment. We're going to get together on Monday to talk about, to try to do precisely this. At any rate, I found precisely the kind of substantial agreement I just talked about in my systematic exploration of Peter Singer and Christian ethics. In some ways, it is sad that this series will be focusing only on abortion and euthanasia, because even though there is broad overlap in the premises of arguments with regard to these issues, the ultimate conclusions are, of course, quite different. But on ethical issues like concern for non-human animals and poverty, for instance, the striking overlap is both with regard to premises and with regard to conclusions. But let's turn to euthanasia. People that study U.S. bioethics have a saying, which only a few of you will get here by me use anyway, abortion is the bowling ball on the mattress of bioethics. This American idiom is difficult to understand unless you watch American television commercials for mattresses, but the basic idea is that our abortion discourse is a muddled mess that prohibits productive discussion of other bioethical issues. This, I would argue, is especially true of euthanasia and of end-of-life issues in several ways. People on multiple sides of the abortion debate, some of which we talked about last night, bring their more fundamental views about abortion into the euthanasia debate. And what is actually going on often is a sort of proxy battle in the war over abortion, but fought on the terrain of the issue of euthanasia. And though there is some overlap, and we'll talk about that today, I find that this causes tremendous confusion in the debate over euthanasia. And I hope I can use my remarks to help unpack some of that confusion, or what I see to be that confusion. In my bioethics courses, I divide the readings that I give my students into three different families of issues, general issues: moral status and value, for one; two, killing and treatment; and three, moving from moral claims to prudential judgments about public policy. My experience is that many, if not most, of the problems of our euthanasia discourse come from confusion about which of these three issues has priority, or even which is under discussion at all. Often we talk past each other, talking about one but not the other. So I will divide my remarks on euthanasia such that I can treat each of these issues separately and hopefully avoid at least some of this confusion. So moral status and value. That's the foundational set of claims that sets up everything else, it seems to me. If the patient we are considering is not a person, a being with intrinsic value and a right to life, then discussions about reasons why we may or may not aim at her death will be very different from discussions in which we claim that she is considered to be a person, right? And here the discussion from last night about abortion does loom large, and part of the reason why the abortion debate has infected the euthanasia debate. In my own view, again, building off the discussion last night, all beings which have a rational nature count as persons, and accidental traits which limit their ability to express their rational nature do not change this moral status at all. Examples of such accidental traits include immaturity, in the case of embryos, fetuses, and infants, intoxication, temporary unconsciousness, mental illness, disability, or injury. Such states of affairs do not change the kinds of things that persons are, not change their persistence through time or personal identity. These are not what I referred to last night as nature-changing events. Therefore, when we consider classic cases at the end of life, like persistent vegetative state or persistent unconscious state, I prefer, deep and long-term coma and even brain death, these patients should all count as persons since they have rational natures. They remain living, though damaged, beings who have all the inherent active potential to be rational and relational. Rational and relational are coterminous in a lot of Catholic tradition. And it is this potential is merely frustrated by an injury or a disease. If we think that non-rational human beings, like those who are asleep, temporarily comatose, etc., count as persons, then we should consider these individuals, these patients, to be persons as well, and for the same reason. In my book on Peter Singer and Christian ethics, I point out that one of the interesting agreements that I have with Peter and Julian, I think, though we'll hear, is a judgment against the current medical consensus around brain death. We tell ourselves, in my view, and I think Julian's view, though again I'll let him speak for himself, that we tell ourselves a medical fiction that a living, breathing, pulsing human being with homeostasis is dead. But what we really mean is that there is a difference between a living, pulsating, breathing human being and a person. So actually, in switching, as we did, our view to brain death, we have adopted an important aspect of Singer's and Julian's thought, perhaps even without realizing it, in my view. So I think both Julian and I can agree that we need a more honest appraisal of what we are claiming when we say that a living human organism with homeostasis is dead. Okay, moral status, too quick, but we can come back to some of that stuff. Let's move on to killing and treatment. But even if one thinks that all these patients are persons, there are still really interesting and important questions to ask about whether it would ever be legitimate to aim at their death. After all, we allow killing of persons for all sorts of reasons, including certain circumstances without their consent. Now, I come out of a tradition, the Catholic tradition, which brings a pretty solid deontological principle to this debate, namely that it is always wrong to aim at the death of an innocent person. This comes directly from the claim that lives of persons have intrinsic, non-instrumental value such that it is never accepted to radically reduce that value to some other end, especially via killing. Though this might seem like a conversation stopper when it comes to dialogue for those who do not share this principle, there are two important possible areas of overlap to mention and possibly explore in greater depth. First, pay attention to the language I'm using, aiming at death. Julian and Peter Singer often point out that it is incoherent to object to killing via an action, but not to object to killing via omission. Here, of course, we have broad agreement. The Catholic prohibition is against aiming at death of an innocent person. This explicitly includes both acts and omissions. The example I use with my students is my bathtub example. So imagine a scenario where this really bad husband wants to kill his wife for the life insurance money, and she's taking a bath, right? And he walks in with the toaster ready to drop it in the water. But to his horrific delight, he realizes that she's drowning already in the bathtub, right? And just, he could easily save her, but he lets her die because he wants her dead, right, for the life insurance money. Is that any different than if he had actually dropped the toaster in the water? From the Catholic perspective, and I think from Julian's perspective, there is no difference at all. Is aiming at death in both circumstances, whether it happens by action or omission, is not of consequence, morally speaking. So, second area of overlap. But so once again, as with brain death, we agree, I think, with the logical incoherency of our culture on this issue that we make this distinction. But we disagree about which way to resolve it, which way to reason to resolve it. So I think Julian's going to want to say that whether we aim at death actively or whether we aim at death passively, there are circumstances where that should be done, even if it's an innocent person. I'm going to say we should refrain from both, whether it's active or passive. That would. But at least we agree on the incoherency, which is no small thing. Second area of overlap involves the Church's tradition on refusing life-sustaining treatment. As many of you know, the Church did a lot of thinking about this in the Middle Ages, especially with regard to battlefield medicine, and eventually came up with a distinction between ordinary and extraordinary treatment, which I think is still operative in our secular medicine today in the West. We can talk about that if you like, but... One of the first questions that was asked was, well, suicide is always wrong, killing innocent person, including suicide, is always wrong. What about battlefield soldiers who don't want their legs cut off in order to save their life? If they refuse the amputation, are they in fact committing suicide? Are they aiming at their own deaths? And the answer from Catholic moral theology was no, that they did not, because as long as they weren't aiming at death, and death was merely a foreseen but unintended consequence, and they had a proportionate reason, like the really intense pain of having your leg cut off without pain medicine, that would have been acceptable. And over the centuries, lots of different kinds of proportionate reasons have been given as reasons that would be acceptable for refusing life-sustaining treatment. Pain was obviously one, given that example, but even expense and burden on family or affected others is in the tradition, which I think explicitly includes distributive justice. That was what my first book was on. And I think that might be an interesting area that Julian and I could talk about in terms of the kinds of views that he holds about this. And interestingly, at least to me, I think we could also largely agree that in certain circumstances, giving someone a very large dose of pain medication, one that we knew would lead to their death being radically sped up, would be acceptable. I would just insist that the reason the pain medication would be given would be with the intention to control pain, and the death was merely foreseen but not intended, while Julian would, of course, I think, just not insist on that. But at least at the level of public policy, we would admit that this is a legitimate thing to do. I would just insist on different intentions, and divining intention in public policy is a very complicated thing, but anyway... I think that's another thing we could talk about that might be interesting. But let me lastly talk about public policy and think about public policy specifically. So even if one objects to the claim that every living human being is a person with a right to life, and even if one rejects the claim that it is always wrong to aim at the death of an innocent person, there are still questions to ask about the unintended consequences of putting any of this into a public policy. As was mentioned last night, Julie and I are trying, and just now, I guess, I put it in here, Julie and I are trying to write a paper together on how a common focus on flourishing and well-being might bridge gaps between us and between secular and religious discourses more generally. So let me propose an important question, well, I think it's an important question. What does a culture look like that has euthanasia as a broadly available option? Is this a flourishing culture? We could ask this about the medical culture specifically, which is a whole set of questions in itself, or we could ask it about our culture at large. My friends who are social ethicists are generally skeptical of merely focusing on the autonomous choice of individuals and wish to dig deeper and think harder about the social structures underneath that might coerce such choices. We saw last night with the proposition of pro-life feminists that they are skeptical of a focus on autonomous choice for abortion, arguing that given the social structures that still work against women, abortion choice actually ends up coercing and harming women in powerful ways. Many social ethicists reason in a similar way about euthanasia. We have social structures in the West driven by a vigorous market economy and push several kinds of vulnerable populations to the margins as a result of these social structures. This is especially true of those who are old or injured or disabled, such that they can no longer contribute capital and youth to our culture in the proper ways. Given that these vulnerable populations are already pushed to the margins and feel unwelcome in our culture, what unintended consequences might there be in giving them the right to kill themselves? Some answers to this question would involve something like reasonable speculation about what might happen, but some answers are just simply empirical. The Netherlands, for instance, has been considering a measure to allow euthanasia for those who are simply tired of life. No pretense about medical need at all. Switzerland, as you may know, has a group called Dignitas that is now charging a fee for what is essentially euthanasia tourism. Here the market is directly involved, with no pretenses about that. I gave a talk in Belgium this past spring, and after the talk, I had dinner with a few of the people who were players in the euthanasia debate there. It was legalized in 2002, but despite warnings from some of the people I was talking with, it took only 6 years for euthanasia to be connected to organ donation. And given organ shortages, the practice gives Belgian society an explicit stake in the deaths of people with seriously disabling or terminal conditions. And if we consider that these people are often the most expensive for whom to care, especially in light of the acute medical resource shortages we face, there is the potential for a perfect storm of considerations which demonstrate that the supposed free choice to kill oneself is actually manipulated and even coerced by a host of social factors operating beneath the surface of so-called patient autonomy. So I've talked enough. I'm just going to conclude here and turn this over to Julian so we can get some exchange. But in concluding, let me make two broad points that sort of back up. So while we may not get broad agreement on some of the principles involved in these debates, even simply cutting through the confusion to see where we disagree, I think, is of significant value for the discourse and just in general. But then I think we can even push our culture to be more together. We can push our culture to be more consistent where we both see incoherency, even if we disagree about which way to push to make it coherent. I think this is especially true when it comes to brain death and aiming at death by action or omission. Another opening for conversation, again, involves the effects of various euthanasia public policies on the flourishing of our communities. Last night I asked the question, whatever you think of abortion as an individual moral issue in itself, what do you think of a culture that has, you know, millions of abortions done for any reason at all? Can we have a productive argument about whether this is good for the flourishing of women and our broader culture? Today I want to ask a similar question about euthanasia. Whatever you think of euthanasia as an individual moral issue in itself, what do you think of a culture that gives the free choice for marginalized populations to kill themselves? Can we have a productive argument about whether this is good for the flourishing of the sick and elderly and our broader culture?
Thanks, Charlie. So just in answer to that, I quite like Holland and Switzerland. I think they're quite good places. So I think they're quite civilized societies. In fact, more civilized than many other societies. But that's not my main point. I want to start by saying what I said last night is many of my best friends are Christians and actually practicing Christians. So I am actually deeply committed to this project of engagement, and I want to thank Charlie for taking a positive step towards this and having an open and honest dialogue and not trying any shenanigans, which I've seen a lot of in the years in this sort of area. And so in that spirit, I've actually written a new paper, and this isn't the paper I would give defending euthanasia, because I'm not going to talk about moral status. The traditional arguments that are given for euthanasia are twofold. One is based on personal autonomy, that we have the right to determine our own lives, including when we die, and so this grounds voluntary euthanasia. And an argument based on beneficence, that some lives involve such degrees of suffering or such poor quality that it's better to no longer go on and live. And this grounds non-voluntary euthanasia. And I'm not going to give either of those arguments. And I'm not going to directly challenge Charlie's claims about moral status. I take the spirit of this debate to be to find common premises that we can agree on. So there are going to be things that we just can't agree on. And I made some comments about
Charlie's reference to both secular and religious ethics being based on faith, which I'm not going to repeat, and we can talk about that later, but I don't quite agree with how he phrased that. So I'm not going to talk about moral status. For what it's worth, I think that people with advanced brain damage, advanced dementia, permanent unconsciousness, lack moral status. But my argument isn't going to depend on that. And I agree with Charlie that I think brain death is a fiction. It's a fiction invented to harvest organs. And the more relevant moral point is some serious loss of sophisticated or rich consciousness that separates humans rather than non-human animals. But leave aside all of that. What he did draw attention to is this very important agreement about the moral equivalence of what's called active and passive euthanasia. Active euthanasia is the administration of, or the direct lethal act that kills a person, typically a lethal injection. Passive euthanasia is the withholding of medical treatment, life-prolonging medical treatment that keeps somebody alive. The omission to do something to keep somebody alive. Now, there is an interesting category of medical treatment that is routinely employed that falls between these two cases of active and passive euthanasia, and that's the act of withdrawing life-prolonging medical treatment. Now, here we face the first hypocrisy of society. If I snuck into the John Radcliffe Hospital now and disconnected somebody's ventilator, I would be guilty of murder because the act that I did, stopping the ventilator, killed the patient. If I snuck into the neonatal intensive care unit and withdrew the feeding tube and or substituted some inert substance for the feed and that baby died of starvation, I would be guilty of murder. If a mother failed to feed her child, that would, if not be murder, a serious criminal offence. But when doctors do that, it's not classified as murder. Now, how can that be? Well, this was most clearly articulated in the case of Tony Bland, a man who was crushed in the Hillsborough soccer disaster. And I think around 1996, after he'd been unconscious for many years, his brain had turned to mush. There was no hope, it was said, of any sort of meaningful recovery. His family wanted his artificial feeding to stop. And the doctors were concerned that by actively stopping his feeding, they would be charged with murder. So they took it to the highest court in the land. And eventually, the decision was that Tony Bland had no interests, and it was not against his interests to stop feeding in this circumstance. And on the question of whether this would constitute murder, the judges said that the act of stopping the treatment was not an act, it was an omission to act, because if it was an act, it would be murder. So that's why doctors are not guilty of murder, and I would be if I did the very same act. If I did it, it would be called an act. If they do it, it's called an omission, which is an absolute tribute to the hypocrisy, the moral hypocrisy of people. So I completely agree with Charlie. Those acts or omissions are morally equivalent. So it's important to recognise that already a form of euthanasia, withdrawal of treatment, withdrawal of feeding in neonates, withdrawal of feeding from people with dementia, withdrawal of ventilation from people in intensive care, is routinely practiced. It is part of routine medical practice. So euthanasia, what I would actually classify as active euthanasia, is already a part of accepted medical practice. As Charlie mentioned, there's one seat here if you want.
Sorry, wrong one.
As Charlie also mentioned, we do sanction the killing of innocent people, and I mentioned this case last night, but I'll mention it again. The case of conjoined twins, such as the Jodie and Mary pair in Manchester a few years ago, one of them, Mary, the so-called weaker twin, who was inevitably going to die but could threaten the life of the healthy twin, Jodie, was killed. And in fact, one of the justices said this was murder, but it was judged to be justifiable murder. So the first point I'll make is that the society that we live in, the medical practices and the law are already based on an acceptance of certain kinds of intentional killing. Okay, now I want to sort of, I've softened you up a bit. I want to move on to the more productive part. Now, Charlie and I both agree that active and passive euthanasia are morally equivalent. So now I'm going to start with some things that I think we can agree on. A very well-trodden principle that he in fact articulated with his battlefield example. People have the right to refuse medical treatment, even life-saving medical treatment. Jehovah's Witnesses can refuse a blood transfusion because they believe if they refuse a blood transfusion, they'll go to heaven, and if they accept somebody else's blood, or even their own blood when it's left their body, they'll turn to dust. That's well regarded as a right that people have. So people are allowed to refuse treatment now and in advance. A Jehovah's Witness can write, you know, an advance directive or a living will saying, I refuse a blood transfusion, whatever the circumstance, if I'm going to die, and that has the force of law. People have the right to refuse medical treatment in advance with the implication that they'll die. Now, if they're going to die, they're inevitably going to die because they refuse medical treatment. Surely, it's compassionate or benevolent to make that dying as easy as possible. So surely, if they're going to die, we should provide them at least with what I call anaesthetic palliative care. That is, anaesthetise them with propofol until they die. Or in fact, Charlie even opened an even better door. Since our intention is not to kill them because they're going to die anyway because they refuse, we can give them a lethal dose of morphine. Because, and that's been, again, well accepted in the courts, that you can give pain relief for seeing that you'll kill the patient when your intention is to relieve suffering. So if people can refuse medical treatment, and I think Charlie should agree with that, because otherwise he's really radically rewriting medical ethics, then those people are entitled to at least anaesthetic sedation and, I would argue, active euthanasia to facilitate their death. So here we have, we've started with an uncontroversial premise, right to refuse medical treatment, and we've already accepted one class of euthanasia. In fact, he raised this spectre of tying organ donation to euthanasia. There's one seat in front of me. So in fact, I've embraced this with a paper with Dominic Wilkinson. We argue for this proposal called organ retrieval euthanasia. We argue that people in advance should be entitled to express the preference that if their treatment will be withdrawn on the grounds of futility or poor prognosis, instead of them being allowed to die over a period of time that ruins their organs, they should be allowed to say, I want to be taken to theatre and my organs be taken while I'm still alive and those organs can be used. So in advance, they could express the wish for what we call organ retrieval euthanasia. So the tying of organs to euthanasia is not necessarily something that we should fear. Okay, now, I tried to argue that people who believe in a right to refuse medical treatment should accept certain instances of euthanasia. Now I'm going to say that that's even broader. It's a recent case of Tony Nicholson, a man who suffered a stroke at the age of 51 and was left in locked-in syndrome. He was fully conscious but unable to move any part of his body, except I think he could blink. He died at the age of 58, having refused nutrition and hydration and antibiotics, having lost a court battle to give his doctor immunity if the doctor assisted his suicide. So this went to court, and the court said, this is not something we can decide, this is something for Parliament to decide. Very soon after, he died. Okay, what did he die of? He died because he had refused to eat and any further medical treatment, but he'd refused to eat. Now, everyone has the basic human right to refuse to eat. I don't think Charlie is going to say that we should be force-feeding people who refuse to eat. And they should have the right to refuse to eat in the future. So if somebody says, you know, if this happens to me, I refuse to be fed. In fact, in the Bland case, feeding was judged to be a medical treatment, but we don't need to go that far because we can simply base the argument on everyone's common human right to refuse to eat or drink. Now, if somebody has refused to eat, they will inevitably die. And if they will inevitably die in this manner, they will inevitably suffer. So they have an entitlement on the grounds of beneficence or compassion to alleviate that suffering as they're dying. Again, they're entitled to at least anaesthetic palliative care to be anaesthetised during the dying process of their starvation. And I'm sure Tony Nicholson wasn't allowed to remain fully conscious as he died. He died very quickly after the court case. Or, in fact, we can employ this wonderful intention-foresight distinction and say our intention is to give him a high dose of morphine for seeing that he'll die, but our intention is to relieve pain. So, in fact, all of us have a de facto right to a certain kind of euthanasia in virtue of being able to make decisions about what goes in our mouth. So unless you're prepared to say that Nicholson should have been force-fed against his will, then all of us can in fact access a form of euthanasia through our right to refuse food and fluids. So, for example, I could say now, if in the future I'm incontinent, or if in the future I can't recognise the people around me, or if in the future I don't know who I am, I refuse permission for you to feed me in those circumstances. Okay? I also refuse antibiotics and artificial ventilation, CPR, etc. But I refuse to be fed. In my view, that should be a legally binding directive. And at that point, people should be given either, as I said, anaesthetic palliative care or a lethal injection under the intention-foresight distinction. Okay, so I think, starting from very simple premises, either about the right to refuse medical treatment or the right to refuse food, we can go quite a long way to allowing people to access control over their dying. The third point, and then I'll finish, is I share what I suspect Charlie has over a vast range of scepticism over a vast range of medical decisions. Decisions that are made about quality of life. Now, in many cases, medical treatment is stopped or withheld on one of two grounds. Not that the person's refused it, because they didn't express any desires and they're unconscious now, but on the grounds of futility, that is, it won't work, there's no chance of survival. But note in Tony Bland's case, he could have been kept alive for another 10 years. Or on the grounds of quality of life, that their quality of life is so poor that their life is no longer worth living. But no, that won't apply to Tony Bland either, because he had no quality of life. He didn't have a negative quality of life, and the claim was not that continued living was against his interests. It wasn't a violation of his interests to stop treatment. So both of these grounds are often, I think, spuriously employed. And here's a good example of it. There was a famous case, I'm not sure if I mentioned this last night, so cut me off if I'm going around in circles, of Jamie Bowen in the 1990s, a young girl who had leukemia, was treated with bone marrow transplant. The bone marrow transplant failed, the leukemia returned. And her father went to Cambridgeshire Health Authority and Huntington Health Authority and said, I want you to try another bone marrow transplant. And the authority said, it's not in her interests to have another transplant. You often hear this in medicine. It's not in her interests. It will cause pain and suffering, infection, and it's only got, I can't remember whether it was 5 or 10% chance of inducing a remission. And he said, well, I disagree. I think it is in her interests. And I said, no, it's not in her interests. So he said, well, I'm taking you to court. So he went to court. And as soon as it got to court, the health authority's argument shifted. They didn't say it was in against her interests any longer. They said, it's not a fair distribution of scarce healthcare resources. Okay? And in fact, the first judge said, you can't just say that. You have to show why it is you can't afford this treatment. But in fact, when it went to the highest court, the judgment was effectively a utilitarian judgment that said scarce healthcare resources have to be distributed to bring the greatest good to the greatest number. And they endorsed the health authority's decision to not provide her care. But again, Mark Sheehan and I were involved in this discussion about people who request treatment to continue for their children in intensive care, Great Ormond Street, while they wait for a miracle. And the doctors believe it's not in the interest of the child to continue treatment. Okay. Now, Steve Clark made the point that it's bizarre to claim that they should know when a miracle is going to occur, that a child could be brought back from the dead years later if God really wanted to perform a miracle. So that doesn't seem to be a strong ground. But it's also true, I think, that in many of these cases, it's not at all clear, having worked in this area for many years, that it is against the child's interest to die at that point. What is really going on, as Charlie said, is the elephant in the room of distributive justice, that people are making decisions that to continue to spend large amounts of resources on this person where the quality of life will be, if positive, very minimally positive, and the life will be very poor, then those resources should be spent elsewhere. And I think that's a very valid judgment to make, but it's a distributive justice judgment. It's not a judgment about futility, it's not a judgment about quality of life. And where Charlie and I think would disagree is I think you have to make those judgments on value of life grounds. It's not as if everyone is equal in this regard. Some lives are better than others, and that's how we should distribute our resources. So the reason that it's legitimate to withdraw medical treatment from severely disabled neonates or severely disabled adults is because those lives are going to be so bad. Now, that I think we will disagree about, but both of us are united on the ground that distributive justice can be a reasonable ground for euthanasia. So we can agree, first of all, that competent people should have access to either euthanasia or anaesthetic palliative care if they refuse to eat in advance or contemporaneously. And we can agree that incompetent people can have treatment withdrawn or the euthanasia administered on distributive justice grounds. So in fact, there's much more agreement than you would think initially between Charlie and I, at least on the premises as I understand it. Now, he raises many objections, and these are familiar objections. I don't want to turn this into a standard debate around euthanasia, but I'll just say something about the vulnerable. Okay. You often hear this concern about, you know, the vulnerable will suffer. And that's a reason for not allowing euthanasia. But as Charlie just said, active euthanasia is equivalent to passive euthanasia. And passive euthanasia is vastly more common, even in the Netherlands and Switzerland, than active euthanasia. So if your concern was exploitation of the vulnerable, then you better be concerned already about exploitation of the vulnerable in terms of people's not having the medical care or having the medical care withdrawn inappropriately. And as I said, there's no evidence from the Holland, a very civilised country, of any of the predicted abuses and so on of euthanasia. And the fact that people request to die when they're tired of life hardly seems to me to be an overwhelming objection. There was a famous philosopher called Michael Bales who always said, I'm going to commit suicide at 50 and I don't want to live any longer than 50. Now, I'm 40. Nearly 49, I find this prospect shocking. But he started to wind up all his book projects and, you know, all his writing and commitments. Sure enough, 50K, committed suicide. Now, people live their lives differently. I wouldn't do that. But it hardly seems to me this is the reductio ad absurdum of allowing people control over their dying. Let me finish there and open up some questions.
Thank you both. Questions? Sharon.
Going back to Charlie's arguments, you didn't actually mention religious faith at all. You mentioned Catholic theology. You also said that the secular view is based on faith as well. But if it is, I mean, if there is something it taken for granted at the root of things, they're very different things. The theological position is about the workings of the universe and a being who is transmitting information to you, presumably about what really matters. That's totally unlike the secular. And if you're going to base your arguments if you're going to have theology-based arguments, then surely they must make some reference that being and its existence. Whereas if you go into the secular arguments at the end that you go, do we want to live in this kind of society, you're not making any use of religion at all. So I don't see that there is any engagement between you, except for a few superficial things, which are not the essence of the issue.
So, totally unlike the secular. Pretty strong.
Yes.
It's certainly like the secular in that it's the claim that one counts as one and none more than one is a first principle that is not argued for, that is just assumed by some sort of authority.
Well, except that you've got to specify the kind of one, and you specify the kind of one that's human, and you said humans all have a certain kind of potential, but you haven't explained why that should be so.
Right.
Whereas the secular can very easily explain, in terms of the thing they're taking as fundamental, why some humans should not count as one.
That's getting into the debate about whether it's convincing or not. I'm just saying, where does it come from? What is the source of the authority that creates the first principle for a utilitarian that says one is, why isn't the one that's a king count more than one that's a servant, right? That seems to be the way most of history has gone, but utilitarians say, no, actually that's not right. They both count as one and none more than. And my question is, that it's every utilitarian. Yeah. And of course utilitarians come from Christian, first utilitarians were all Christian.
But that's all causal, that isn't justificatory.
Right. But the point is that they are not totally unlike theologians' first principles, are not totally unlike secular first principles in that they are unargued for. They come from an authority that people who don't share in the narrative or the tradition can accept. And they might not come from a god, but they certainly come from a source of ultimate concern for a secular person, right? A source of ultimate concern. And so they are unlike in the way that it's not explicitly theological, it's not explicitly based on a supreme being or something like that. But in all the ways I mentioned, they're very much alike.
There was one thing I mentioned, because I said something was. But I'll say something different to what I said last night. So I was at this debate between Richard Dawkins and who's the Archbishop of Canterbury? Rowan Williams. And we had a dinner afterwards. And Lord Patton, the Chancellor, Chris Patton. Now, right at the end, said, look, Richard, isn't your position at bottom about the Big Bang just based on faith, like his position about the origin of the universe and God? And Richard Dawkins sort of, you know, faffed around and didn't actually really give a... He said, ah, yes, but I don't have all this romance about him. But the real difference is that Dawkins, if he's half a scientist, should be prepared to revise his position in the light of new evidence or new argument. And that, I think, is... So, you know, I think well-being is a fundamental value. Yes, okay, that's a base value. But I think, you know, it matters to everyone. Everyone cares how their lives go. It seems to be pretty uncontroversial shit. But if somebody gives me good arguments why that shouldn't be a value, I'm prepared to revise that. But when it comes to the rock-bottom commitments of religious ethics, you don't have that flexibility. Or else it's not really, it's not, as Janet says, it's not really religious. We're talking about common values, but there's nothing distinctive about it.
Janet, can we come back to that? Is that all right?
Theology usually has a lot of well-being in its background in that you go to heaven or hell, and that is a causal connection with how you've behaved.
Well, I think we might come back to that. David.
Question for Charlie is to do with the secular and religious. Alan said, you know, which religion, what secular? I mean, are we talking about Aristotelians or utilitarians or Kantians or Heideggerians or Gadamerians or Wittgensteinians or Kierkegaardians or Pascalians? I mean, what kind of secular view? I mean, is Plato secular? He has a god. Aristotle has a god. On the other hand, which religion is it? Is it Catholic? What kind of Catholic? I mean, you know what kind of Catholic is a big question. Or evangelical, liberal, Anglican, or Muslim, who also vary, but people that don't realise that. Or Jewish, or Buddhist, or... I mean, it seems to me this debate has been set up with two possible interlocutors, but both are more diverse, and if there's more aware diversity, then the notion that there is only one secular, for example, might be more problematic. And a question for Julian, and it's about inconsistency, really. Is it a problem if the law is inconsistent? I mean, from a utilitarian point of view, or from, I'm not sure where you are in terms of how you categorise yourself, but do you think it's a problem if the law is inconsistent? Because it seems to me the law will often be inconsistent, and pursuing consistency in the law isn't necessarily, one way or the other, isn't necessarily helpful in terms of public policy.
Mm-hmm. Do you want to go first to that?
Yeah. I actually don't think it matters that much, as long as we just describe it in the following way. So by secular, I don't mean a Christian philosopher who's working in a secular world or something like that. I just mean someone who doesn't believe in God, but yet makes normative claims using first principles and of any kind. So I just chose a secular, atheist, utilitarian, typical one. I could pick lots of others, right? So that one counts as one and none. More than one is a classic example of a dogma that comes from some sort of authoritative claim that comes from a tradition that those outside the tradition don't share, but yet is still functions as normative. Now, you call it faith, you call it something else, you don't like calling it faith, that's fine. But and then the kind of religious person I'm talking about, again, I don't think it matters except in so far as we're talking about a religious person who thinks there is a God who does have some normative things to say about how we should live our lives. And those are that constitute first principles for how we think about ethics, like you should never kill an innocent person. So the claims that one counts as one and none more than one because of a utilitarian dogma that comes from a utilitarian narrative is not different in kind, it seems to me, from the claim that God says you should never kill an innocent person.
So on you, where is Kant in this? I mean, is he religious or is he secular? And where are deists who have kind of natural religion for you? Or are they religious or secular?
Yeah, I think those questions are really complicated, and we probably need to sit down and talk for an hour or so about it. But I'm really only trying to clear the conceptual space to talk to secular atheists who would want to put theological first principles in some weird sort of witchcraft type category as different from what they're doing, so that we can actually talk on a similar playing field.
So, I mean, I completely agree with you with the sort of premises behind your question. I said this last night, but Catholics vary enormously. You have very fundamentalist Catholics and you have very liberal Catholics. Secularists, you go from very fundamentalist to people. And the people at the extremes, I think it's going to be difficult to make any progress on either side. But some people in the middle, I think, that can move to some degree. So, I agree with you, these categories. I mean, I think I said that we are all most fundamentally, individual persons, not Catholics, atheists, whatever. So I think that that's right. And in terms of the inconsistency of the law, it is worrying if some sets of values or practices are inconsistent. Now, of course, there can be reasons that would be a good thing, but the burden should be on to justify the inconsistency. It's a kind of violation of Aristotle's principle of equality, so you have to show her. Mm-hmm. And, it may be a good thing that the law is as it is, and it would be worse if it became consistent. But I think those arguments have to be made, and first of all, you have to acknowledge the inconsistency. Mm-hmm. So I wasn't saying this should be overall, but I think the most basic method for some of the sort of the first years, most basic method of practical ethics is a pattern is consistency. Try to at least, get at a consistent set of values and principles, and if they're inconsistent, you need to be able to justify.
Thank you, Julian and Charlie, for engaging on this, because it's certainly an article of faith in my personal relationship with my partner that we can make this secular religious dialogue work on moral choices. Just want to take you guys back to the debate, to the one area where I felt there wasn't a direct engagement between the two cases that were put forward, which is around the question of arguments derived from individual choice and individual rights. So specifically, the argument, Julian, that you advanced from the right to refuse to eat. And so my question to you, Julian, is that, to me, I'm not sure if I do accept a priori as a liberal secularist that is a right to always refuse to eat. Certainly when you have cases where mental health is potentially an issue, I apologise if this is offensive to anyone, but I'm just fraught on this myself around treatment for anorexia and other things, where there is certainly a view that force feeding can be necessary in order to get people through a temporary mental illness and get them to the other side. So my question, I guess, to you is, what does that do for this argument? And to Charlie, I guess I wonder whether, from the theological perspective, do you accept a priori that individual choice is always a good thing, or would the religious theology argument come work back to choice from a kind of view of well-being and good? Does that make sense? Just try and get that.
Yeah. So anorexia is one of the most difficult, refusal of feed, forced feeding of anorexia, one of the most difficult issues in this huge legal and ethical controversy. In fact, I don't want to go into this whole basis of this argument. I think anorexics should have the right to refuse and shouldn't, in all cases, be forced fed. But that's a complicated argument to make. But even if we grant that people with mental illness and anorexia is such a mental illness shouldn't be forced fed, that won't apply to people who are fully competent and don't have some deficiency in their competence or rationality or are suffering from mental illness. So, most people reject the idea of euthanasia for people with mental illness. In fact, again, Holland, kind of trailblazer, has performed euthanasia for mental illness. There's a case, the Chabot case, of euthanasia performed for depression. A woman had intractable depression, I think after the death of her husband and one of her sons or something, it had gone on for years, and she wanted to die. Now, I think even in the case of mental illness, it's not clear that people shouldn't be able to access euthanasia, but even if you wanted to hide that off, it still won't affect most of us.
So, I think the clear answer is no, it's certainly not always a good thing. If it is a good thing, it is walked back from more foundational commitment to the common good. And certainly evil understandings of choice that come out of an Enlightenment context, which seems to be trying to deal with pluralism or something like that, are especially, in my view, under some serious skepticism, precisely because they seem to ignore the social structures underneath them. And so a lot of my colleagues that do Catholic social teaching, I do some Catholic social teaching too, talk a lot about structural sin or structural injustice that gets overlooked when we have a disproportionate focus on individual choice, and actually individual choices, focus on individual choices can dramatically hurt the common good if we're not sufficiently aware of that structural injustice.
Yeah.
Yes, thank you both. I should have thought everybody would agree that there are a vast range of different types of cases which raise very different moral issues. I mean, from those who are demented but cheerful to those who are, as you say, anorexic or determined to starve themselves to death or whatever. But one thing that I'm surprised has not come up, and which I should have thought does have quite a substantial historical basis in this debate, is that presumably it makes some kind of difference to your view on this, whether you believe that this life is all there is, or whether you believe that life persists for human beings indefinitely beyond the grave, and that human beings have a destiny, and that therefore part of their vocation might be actually to endure to the end. And I think that has been, for many Christians, quite a strong piece of motivation. I mean, I've known people who've actually said, I welcome this suffering. And I should have thought that the question of life after death really does bear on how much common ground there can be.
I absolutely don't believe in a life after death, but paradoxically, I want to, for that reason, want to keep living as long as possible. I don't want any advanced directives, I don't want to die, even if I'm Tony Bland, I want to be kept alive as long as possible. So I think the best two grounds, but everyone's different, so I think the best two grounds for shortening people's lives are that they want it themselves, and other people with different of it, and distributive justice. I think society's quite entitled to say, we're not keeping you alive in that state for the next 20 years. You have to accept that one. But I agree with you. It depends on your view, but I don't think it goes quite as straightforwardly as if you're... I think many people are confused, and they think that there's going to be something after death, so they may as well get rid of the suffering now and move on to the better parties. I think that's a profoundly mistaken. Stay around as long as possible.
I'd also add to that, I think it's... at least from my tradition, I want to say that... decisions made because you want to get to heaven or not sort of miss the point in some way. So
you know, if you're giving money to the poor because you want to go to heaven or something, that's sort of a missed point in a big
way. I wasn't suggesting people feel they have an obligation to God or to their vocation, their
right.
specific vocation.
Right, but presumably that vocation, that duty would exist anyway, even if heaven wasn't part of the equation.
Yes, of course.
Yeah.
I'm not talking about heaven or hell, I'm just talking about actually surviving.
Yeah.
Son.
Yeah, Charles, you said that taking action to kill someone and allowing them to die are morally equivalent when we're aiming at their death. Now, I suspect that you hold that claim based on faith, so pointing out that your argument for it isn't very good might not have any effect, but I'll try to anyway.
Okay.
So the argument you used was to give an example where it looks like an allowing is very bad as much as a killing is. So allowing your wife to die in the bath because you wanted the life insurance is, of course, impermissible, and there's no moral difference between the cases. But to test whether there's any difference between killing someone and allowing them to die, we need to look for cases where there might be a difference. So,
where there's still aiming at death going on in both cases.
Where there's what?
Just be sure that, at least for my argument to go through, there would have to be an intention to kill,
or
intention for death to come.
Okay.
Yeah.
So here's a case like that. So you're standing by the side of the railway line, and there's an out-of-control boxcar coming along, and there are six people tied to the track, but they're in the following groups. There are five people tied to the track some distance ahead, and there's one person who's very heavy tied right next
to
you.
This is the fat man example.
Now, you can untie someone from the track and save them, but you haven't got time to untie all six. So, if you want, you can untie and release the fat man, and he won't die, but the five ahead of him will, as a result of your untying and releasing the fat man. So if you do nothing, the trolley will hit and kill the fat man, and the five will not die. If you act to save the fat man, the five will die. So no one's going to thank you for taking this action. No one's going to say, well, yeah. So the fat man may thank you, but people in general aren't going to thank you for your heroic saving. Now, if you decide not to act, of course, you're aiming at his death, right? You want his body to stop the trolley.
No.
You're not. Okay. So, okay. Why are you not aiming at his death?
Because I might just choose not to act. I might say this is a tragic situation or something like that.
Sorry, if you're allowing it to happen, you're allowing it to happen because you want him to block the trolley, right?
Why? I could have a different reason, right?
Well, you could have a different reason.
Yeah. I could just say this is a tragic situation in which I'm not going to act.
Okay, so if you're standing by a forked track and the trolley's heading towards five, and you could divert it down a branch line where it will kill anyone, you wouldn't divert it in that case?
I would divert it in that case because then the death of that one is not the means by which I'm saving the five.
Right, so I take it. Okay. So you wouldn't act in the second case, but that's because...
I would divert it in a situation where I foresee but not intend the person would die.
Right. So, in other words, you're good. Okay. So you're not going to intervene in the first case, even though you think it's impermissible on this very ground, right, that it would violate your principle of aiming at the death of one to save others, right? But you say, oh, I'm just going to have some other reason for not intervening.
Right.
But you don't know what that is.
The reason is I don't want to do something that's impermissible.
Hang on, but we're just questioning the principle that you're basing its impermissibility on.
Right, and you might disagree with that principle, but I'm saying
right.
if I have the principle
okay.
that it's always going to be wrong to aim at the death of an innocent person, and aiming at the death includes using someone as a means to save somebody else, which it looks like,
right.
I don't know if I fully understand the situation, but if I've understood it correctly, that is what's happening. I'll say the proper thing to do is not to act, but the intention in not acting is not to save the five, it's to say I just won't act to kill an innocent person, either as a means or an end.
So you wouldn't be acting to kill anyone if you save the fat man. How would you be you'd be acting to save someone? I'm asking you to allow him to die.
Oh, so I guess I've misunderstood the situation. You're
perhaps saying, perhaps we can come back to this.
Okay.
Sure.
Okay.
Tony.
Just want to raise a question about the right to refuse to eat. Julian was saying that you both agree on this, but I think that depends a bit. First of all, following Charlie, I think we should distinguish between the moral issue and the political issue, or the public policy issue. And if we look at the public policy or political issue, both of you probably would agree, leaving aside the cases of the people with impaired capacity and so on, that people shouldn't be forced to eat if they decide they don't want to eat. But on the moral issue, I think Charlie's going to disagree with you, and I'm sort of open to asking him about this. Because I take it he's against suicide generally on various grounds, so he's going to say that somebody who refuses to eat with the intention of killing themselves doesn't have a moral right to that, that this is something morally wrong. So sadly, I think I'm pulling out a plank between the incipient agreements that seem to be going along this score. So I just wonder if that is the case. I think I've interpreted the position correctly.
Yeah, but I think you're exactly right. But the really important point to stress is the bit you started with, that legally, yes. Legally, we both of us should agree that people shouldn't be force-fed. And that's enough to drive a case for some form of euthanasia. So if they're going to die,
yeah,
then, you know, and they're going to suffer. I mean, I hope Charlie's compassionate enough to say we should alleviate their suffering, even though we think that they're doing the morally wrong, even though he thinks they're doing the morally wrong thing.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure about how he would get on the public policy question. My own position is, of course, that I'm also a Catholic, but I don't think there's a deep moral objection to suicide, and I don't think there's a deep moral objection to euthanasia. I do think there may be serious public policy questions to be settled. I think, I mean, he's dead right that that's a separate and important question. But I wonder, well, just need to know on this, but what do you think on the public policy question about, given that you would think that somebody who decides not to eat in order to kill themselves is doing something deeply morally wrong,
yeah.
Do you think there's a public policy question about stopping them by, say, force-feeding?
Yeah, I do. I think we put, at least I don't know what happens here, but in the United States we put prisoners on suicide watch, and so if they try to commit suicide, we have people watching them to make sure that they don't and stop them from doing so. So then the question would become, if that's legitimate as a public policy to do, would it be legitimate to stop someone from starving themselves to death as a method of suicide?
Even if they're in prison.
Right, even if they're in prison, especially if they're in prison. That's why, like, we have...
Because that's something they can readily do.
Exactly. So I guess there is this added thing of bodily autonomy that's maybe separate from making sure somebody doesn't hang themselves, that we would need to consider as a relevant factor. But I'm not willing to rule it out a priori and say, well, just because it involves force-feeding somebody, which we do in other circumstances, like anorexia and others, that it would just be off the table. We take, and I think rightly, preventing criminals from committing suicide very seriously. Even, interestingly, criminals on death row, there have been situations where criminals have tried to hang themselves and they've been resuscitated and then executed a week later.
If you think that's a good idea, then I'm part of government.
Yeah, well, I think this is quite revealing, because I think that maybe Charlie doesn't view this, but at least some people I've heard have said, you know, the reason why suicide is wrong is that your body is not your property, it's God's property, and you don't have the right to make that decision. So for these people, everyone is a prisoner. And so everyone is a prisoner of life. And it's nobody's prerogative to do that. Now, you might think that prisoners should serve their sentence. That's a part of the judicial system. And this is what grounds this idea that they have to be executed and not kill themselves. So you might think that. But why would you think somebody not in prison has to serve some kind of sentence? Unless you thought that it was God's decision about when they die. So I really, you know, can't believe that you think that Tony Nicholson should have been force-fed at the point. Now, you might, whatever you think about prisoners, we're talking about a man with locked-in syndrome who is compos mentis, has made a decision, he doesn't want to eat. And you're saying And not only is he gravely morally wrong, he should be force-fed in that circumstance. And I think that, you know, that's where the kind of the division is. So one of the good things about this constructive debate is we've found out where we really do disagree.
Yeah, that's an important thing. Especially because, you've come back a number of times to the point about having control over our deaths and control. I mean, this is a very important part of sort of libertarian anthropology, right, is that human beings actually do have control of our lives, and we just need the state to give us this control, and then we can have control. But it's interesting to put this in perspective with the arguments you've made about distributive justice, which allow the state to come in and say, actually, not so fast. You're not going to have recourse to do this because of distributive justice, because of your duty to the community. And so I guess that's one of the things that I would want to challenge is the premise of your anthropology of, well, just give people control, or just have control, or how dare you take control. Especially the anthropology of, you know, Catholic social thought is that we just don't have this control. It's an illusion. We have some sort of individual choice that's good, but insofar as it contributes to the common good.
This isn't a theodicy. It's a dictatorship or a form of communism where the state should decide whether I eat or not.
Do you think does the state...
Not me. It's not my... I can't even control what goes in my mouth now.
Does the state have the right to watch you in prison and make sure you don't hang yourself?
Well, I personally, I mean, this is a different situation because punishment is there for many reasons. And if people can get out of punishment by committing suicide, then people might say, you know, there are consequentialist, you know, and retributive justice reasons for preventing them from doing that. Now, I don't think we can look at this. I personally think that they should be prevented from committing suicide because I think in many cases death is an easier way out than suffering. And in those circumstances. So, you know, but I don't think that bears at all on the debate around Tony Nicholson. He's not a prisoner, unless you think he is a prisoner of life that God's imposed on him, which is actually what many people do think.
We can keep going here, but I don't
know. Yeah, yeah.
Just
do you want to clarify it?
Just briefly, I mean, I think that I just want to disavow being libertarian very emphatically. But I think that one can have a strong commitment to a very important value of autonomy or control of one's own life without disavowing that there are circumstances around it and so on, and that there are contexts in which it should be thought of rather than as an absolutely obsessive thing. But it does seem to be a very important thing. It does seem to be that in this context, we talk about suicide, euthanasia, the principle you have about the absolute impermissibility of taking innocent life is one that I have a lot of sympathy with, but I do think that it should be qualified by the idea that it's wrong in absolute and strong terms to take innocent life deliberately, of course, unless you can inform the consent of the person. And there do seem to be many such cases. Look, the case that switched me on the euthanasia thing is the thing that comes up in warfare, but it comes up in other contexts too, where one of your companions is stuck on the barbed wire in no man's land, will die eventually, bleeding to death, in appalling agony, and he calls out for you to shoot him dead. And I cannot see a moral objection to that. But I think you're committed to the moral objection to that. And that seems to me... That's the hinge that moves me away from.
We probably want to move on, but I want to say something in response to that. Yeah. Whatever position we take on whether it's ever acceptable to kill an innocent person or not, we come up with a thought experiment that it just seems totally counterintuitive to take that particular position. So I agree with you. That seems totally counterintuitive. I play, many of you may have seen the movie The Last of the Mohicans. There's an example I play from that movie where one of the characters is burning alive to death on a stake, and the main character shoots him as he's burning alive. Yeah. It's a great one to use in class, by the way. I agree with you. My intuition is this, but if you have the other, if you accept the principle that it's okay to kill innocent person for a proportionate reason, then that opens the door to, in my view anyway, a Pandora.
I don't accept the proportionate reason thing in total. I'm just talking about the consent of the person, and it's not a thought experiment in the philosopher's sense, at which, you know, deep problems with it, fantastical things and so on. This happens in warfare. It has happened. I mean, there are actual cases of it. It's not a story.
I didn't mean it in that sense.
Oh, sorry. No.
Yeah.
We'll move on.
Charlie, so far as you kind of opened the door to the performance of euthanasia under the aegis of proportionate reasoning and principle of double effect, and insofar as part of that moral calculus includes financial considerations, and insofar as we brought distributive justice into this, and social or philosophical cosmopolitanism is a big part of what drives Singer's ethics and Christian ethics indeed, to what degree does the significant expense of maintaining people on life support relative to the enormous amount of impact that the same finances could have if directed to, you know, malaria and diarrhea and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
To what degree should that inform our reflections? And then if I can kind of twist the question to you, what constraints are there on that? Because I feel like Singer would be put in a position where he should be seriously arguing against expensive life-sustaining treatment. So if both of you could kind of hit that from different angles.
So the question you're asking is sort of similar to a question about any sort, any use of resources when in comparison to things like people dying of malaria and diarrhea, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's, this is just another kind of the same kind of question, except that it deals with medical resources. And I get a little nervous when I say that I'm arguing for euthanasia just for the podcast sake. I take euthanasia, at least the way I define it, as some sort of aiming at death, and that's not what I'm arguing for, right? So I don't think it's ever acceptable to aim at death, but I do think it's acceptable to say within various communal contexts that it's disproportionate with the common good to do a really expensive amount of treatment. Of course, we have to talk about, and this is not a problem that's limited to this kind of resource allocation question, it's a problem of all sorts of resource allocation questions. Which community are we talking about it being disproportionate with? So is it the family? Traditional Catholic moral theology said that if you have a child that requires treatment such that you have to put all of your family homeless underneath the bridge, you didn't have to do that treatment, even if you foresaw but did not intend the child would die. So that's within that particular community. Now if you talk about maybe the community of the nation state, maybe you have thinking about the NHS or whatever in terms of that community, you're asking a ridiculously tough question about what Catholic social teaching would say, the community of the world, all are responsible for all. How the hell does that work, right? Mm-hmm. I don't know. I don't know the answer to that, but I don't think it's different in kind from the kinds of questions they would ask about whether we should spend money on our children's college education or university education or something like that versus giving to Oxfam or to Catholic Relief Services or something like that.
So Peter Singer has a book called Should the Baby Live, where he argues in favour of infanticide, and in fact he looks at the costs of neonatal intensive care and you know, compares that to other treatments and other things. And so there are two complications with neonatal intensive care. First of all, replaceability. He thinks that infants are replaceable, so that, you know, it's much cheaper to have a second healthier one. And secondly, you do tend to buy quite a lot because you're saving for a whole life, whereas if you devote... So how these factors, you know, pan out for a utilitarian is complicated. But as you say, they will want to, in general, bring the greatest good to the greatest number. I'm not a utilitarian. So in terms of just assuming that the neonate has a full moral status, and we're talking about one community, I'm a sufficientarian. I think we should bring as many people above some sort of decent minimum. So, you know, it just depends on whether the neonate will go above the decent minimum and how many other people you could bring above that. So, you know, I think whether you should invest in expensive treatments depends on how far up you're getting that individual and what the opportunity cost of that is. Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of global obligations, should we be diverting resources from intensive care to treatment of malaria? You know, this, as Charlie says, is a vexed question. How much priority do we give people within our group versus other groups? So, as I said, I'm not a utilitarian. I don't think that everyone's, you know, well-being counts equally. I believe in what he calls a duty of easy rescue. And it's interesting, I said last night, that whenever Peter has to argue in public, he doesn't talk about utilitarianism. He talks about a duty of easy rescue because, you know, if he did, he'd have to be giving up one of his kidneys now to somebody who'd derive much more benefit. So what does that mean? Well, when the cost to you is small and the benefit to somebody else is large, you should do that. So in terms of the allocation of resources, if reallocating those resources causes a small cost to this community but a great benefit to the other community, we should do that. So that will just depend on, you know, the specific cases under consideration. But I don't think as a general rule we should be devoting money away from expensive life-saving treatments to the third world. I do think, though, we should be devoting money away from the care in the last week or month of life. Something like 50% of the health budget goes to keeping people alive in the last month of life. I can't remember exactly, but it's a huge amount. Mm-hmm. I think we can all live 1 month less and devote that money.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so I guess I had a question for Charlie about a point that was brought up earlier about the social costs of euthanasia, or a lot of euthanasia. And you brought up this specter of coerced euthanasia and these feminist worries about society that will pressure people unjustly. I guess you can look at Netherlands and whether or not this is happening there. I don't know what your views are on that. But as a more general issue, I mean, it seems like these are legitimate worries. But there's another case that I thought there could also be legitimate worries. It's not even hypothetical. But this is the case of medical research. There was a time, 50 years ago, when not just was theoretically possible people would be coerced and treated unjustly and into a certain program, but they were. And then there are gross injustices. Tuskegee syphilis experiment is the most famous, but there's numerous. These Guatemalan studies. It was revealed recently also had egregious violations. But the reaction to this, I mean, there's clearly... Some people were just had not proper consent when entering these studies and ended up being harmed because they entered into these studies. The reaction, and I think the appropriate reaction, is not to say, okay, let's ban medical research. The reaction is, let's regulate it. You know? And that's what's happened since the 70s. It's been an increasingly robust regulation. And, of course, it's not perfect, and there's still flaws, and we constantly revise the regulations. And isn't that the right reaction to that worry? This is a real risk. Just like with medical research, it was a real risk. And the proper thing to do is to have robust regulations, ensuring proper consent and various other institutions. And we'd say, well, maybe Netherlands is or isn't sufficient, but we just need to work on that.
So I guess the word specter is sort of meant to say something, right? But use the word specter. These are real cases in the Netherlands of people feeling pressure to kill themselves, right? And it's not, these are real cases. I mean, you just go to YouTube and you can watch the stories of people who describe precisely this pressure. So it's not a specter in any sense that I'm familiar with that meaning of that term. But yeah, so maybe regulation is the way to go. So let's think about that. And again, if we're going to think about regulation, we'd have to think about this culture and the sources of ultimate concern that drive a culture to do these kinds of things. So what have we seen in the Netherlands? Netherlands is driven quite a bit by social structures which emphasize autonomy and choice. And as... a number of people have pointed out, when a culture is driven by that as their sort of source of ultimate concern, especially when we're talking about medical ethics, it becomes increasingly difficult to regulate euthanasia, because what is the ultimate concern? It's that individuals have the right to do what they want with their bodies. And who is the state or the community to tell them, especially if the state and community is not affected in any serious way that we can see, though I argue that it is, that they can't do this, because it's their body, their choice, their life, their death. And so we might say it's bad or we should regulate it, but those legitimate concerns in a culture that is emphasizing bodily autonomy and choice as its source of ultimate concern seems to be headed down this path in a pretty serious, I think we've seen, if we've gone, because the Netherlands tried to regulate, they had very strict regulations at first. The idea that there would be a serious ballot measure that would allow euthanasia for people who retired life would have been unthinkable in the original regulated sense that the Netherlands had euthanasia. And so when we think about regulation, I think if we could think about it in a way that it could somehow push back against this strong, almost overwhelming force about the individual choice of the autonomous individual. I think that might work, but I think there's some evidence to the contrary. You don't like that answer very much.
Well, I just find it, I mean, I was just going through my mind, I'm not very big on these sort of cultural explanations, but, you know, what you say about the Netherlands, and I've got Dutch friends and I've been there, and you know, this is a country with a high level of social welfare, very high education, a very good public health system. They're not obsessed with individual autonomy in the way that North Americans are. And I think that your concerns, particularly about social construction and social vulnerability and so on, are particularly acute in the United States, where people are exploited, you know, people are oppressed, people don't have adequate support. And maybe it's right that you don't legalise euthanasia in the United States. But I think the Netherlands is a success story. And I think that anyone who genuinely, this story about people on YouTube, I don't know who's put them up to this, but it's certainly not a big social problem in the Netherlands. And I think that maybe it's correct that it's not the correct to have euthanasia in any country. But I think that, you know, I think I've got to stand up for that. I don't know if there are any Dutch people here, but I've never heard a single Dutch people with anything except pride for their system of healthcare, their social welfare and euthanasia in their country. So, you know, I think that what you're saying is a distinctively, and I hate saying this, because I, in general, I don't like it, but I do think it's a particularly United States sort of critique of this.
I did research for my dissertation in the Netherlands, and there was friends of mine from the Netherlands at the talk last night who would agree with this. So I guess, I mean, I don't know what we can garner from saying that we have personal relationships with people there, and this doesn't seem like our
experience. Well, I looked at the data too, and I don't see any evidence of sort of abuse and sort of collapse of the system and somehow allowing people to make wider ranges of choices a bad thing. But anyway, we obviously disagree about that, so...
What's it, did you get it?
Well, it's covered.
That's covered, all right. Alex.
Thanks. Well, I had a question for each of you. My question to Charles was, I think, answered largely. So, because my question had to do with the main kind of concern that's usually raised by the pressure groups, or like the pro-life pressure groups in this debate, and typically they bring out the slippery slope argument that vulnerable people are going to be unacceptably harmed if we legalize euthanasia, no matter what system and what restrictions we use. I take it that this is an argument you are actually sympathetic to.
I'm somewhat sympathetic, but a lot of disability groups make the same kind of arguments, right? So it's not just sort of a pro-life right-wing fringe or something. A lot of disability groups make similar arguments.
Right. So though in the case of these pressure groups, it seems to me that often it's, I mean, I may be wrong about this, but my feeling is that there is some kind of need felt by these groups to phrase their concerns in a secular language. Where, in fact, there are the fundamental considerations that guard their opposition, one being the sacredness of life and the fact that the idea that life doesn't really belong to us, it belongs to God, so it's sinful to take our lives in any circumstances. And from this perspective, it's obviously wrong to legalize euthanasia in any circumstances. I think you also expressed sympathy with this view, but at least I am grateful when someone honestly acknowledges that they accept this view and that this is what drives this party, their attitude, rather than trying to just constrain your arguments in purely secular language, because I think that the slippery slope argument is difficult to defend. That's maybe. Well, thanks for your clarifications anyway. I have one question for Julian on the same topic. So you mentioned this philosopher who says he wants to die at 50. I mean, are there some boundaries that you want to draw there? Because so you said, okay, you would disagree with his attitude, but who are we to stop him from doing that? Now, I agree with you that there might be undue interference if we were like to put him on suicide watch and try and thwart all of his attempts at suicide, but acknowledging is one thing. Saying that he has the right to use the medical system and ask doctors to put him to death when he's perfectly healthy, say he still has 20 or 30 good years to live. I mean, his decision strikes me as irrational. I don't think that the medical system should be expected to help him die.
Well, I mean, here, as Tony said, depends on your commitment to autonomy. The first question to ask is he really autonomous? Is he really competent? Is he really making mean, Bales had a kind of reasoned plan for his life. This wasn't something that just had occurred to him. He wasn't suffering from depression. So it's argued as this is a kind of paradigm case of a pure rational suicide. I'm inclined to put quite a lot more weight than Charlie would on personal freedom and liberty. And I think that, you know, if he's not suffering from some mental health problem, some impairment of rationality, he has reasons for what he wants and he has a kind of coherent story. I think that's a part of free, giving people freedom, that sometimes they will do things that we disagree with. And, the first paper I ever wrote, which nobody would have read, is called The Trouble with Do-Gooders. And, you know, I think there's too much of a paternalistic attitude that, you know, we know how people should live, how long they should live, what. Now, you know, at the end, it's your life. You will die eventually. There, of course, other people's relationship, the state, etc., are important components in that. But it is your life, and you're the one that has to suffer or live it, and it should be you that makes decisions about it. And if that involves choosing to die when other people wouldn't, so be it.
But you can take it. Like, he wasn't in locked-in state, was he?
No, he was walking near. He was producing very good philosophy even until the time he's dead.
Right. So it's different, like, from Tony Nicholson. So, like, his autonomy was in his own hands, as it were. It's still another matter to say doctors should be there and actually involved.
If you can commit suicide, then you should commit suicide. I agree. You shouldn't be involving other parties unless necessary.
Right. That's okay,
I'm not saying that we should have, you know, that if there's a reason. But anyway, I'm not.
Okay.
We're coming to the end. I've got three more. Can I get the three to ask their question, and then we'll get them to return, and then we'll call it a day? David, and then yourself, and then yourself.
Yeah, I'd actually like, surprisingly, to agree, I think, more with Julian than with Charlie with regards to the Nicholson case. I did help write the guidance of the Catholic Church on the Mental Capacity Act for Catholics in this country, and I think there is a question of coercion. When you allow coercion and when you don't, and that's a very independent and very important issue. And I think the right to refuse is quite an important right, not an absolute right, but an important right. And certainly my view would be that if you're going to coerce people, then you need some kind of communal sanction. So if the law has decided that you don't have any communal sanction, then you do have to accept such refusals. And so I think that the doctors in the Nicholson case would have been right to accept his refusals. Wouldn't have in that way been involved with euthanasia. They would have been involved with respecting liberty in a certain way. That wouldn't mean that they had to give medicine, but it would mean that they could respect refusals.
Mm-hmm. Good, thanks. Yeah.
Julian, I've known you for 4 years, and now that I know your first paper was called The Trouble with Do-Gooders, I feel like I really understand you. If you had known Michael Bales, would you have given him reasons to not kill himself?
Yeah, no, look, I think it's what you should do, as Mills said, you should argue with people, you should give them the, you know, why you think they're wrong, you should try to persuade them not to do it. But once you've done all that, and it's the same with the patient, I think if you think the patient is choosing the wrong course of action, it's not paternalism to give them reasons and to argue with them. It's paternalism to deny them choices or force some, you know, action on them. So I think, you know, that's what we should be doing. But we shouldn't be regulating people's freedom in the way that we do today.
Yeah, and that would be a really interesting conversation rather than just the focus of your presentation today on the legal question.
Yeah, no, I mean...
Yeah.
Along similar lines to... when you're talking about suicide, you're talking so much from the individual point of view. This is the individual is totally isolated. But surely the suicide and taking someone's life, you're related to people all around you, and you're doing something to those people by taking your own life or by deciding to end your life.
I completely agree. And I think those are heavy reasons against it that will make it wrong in many circumstances. And, you know, maybe Michael Bales had I can't remember whether he was married, or I'm not sure that he was. But, you know, I think those are important moral considerations. But at the end of the day, once those have been made, the question is, are you going to... What happens today is that you're declared mentally ill and you're involuntarily treated. If you express suicidal ideation, that is, in itself, evidence that you have a mental illness. And I think that's... the paper I read before that, which is just in a little magazine, was about precisely why that was, well, that was wrong. Always classify suicidal ideation as some expression of mental illness.
Hmm. Charlie, you were going to say something in response to David.
I hope this isn't too much Catholic inside baseball question. But, so would you think a Catholic hospital should be forced to accept an advance directive by a patient to remove artificial nutrition and hydration because they, in whatever state the advance directive talked about, they didn't consider it to be a life worth living?
I think that in order to treat in the face of an advanced refusal, they would have to have a law which allowed them to do so.
I think it involves a kind of coercion.
I think that this is an area. It's a sort of liberty question, which is underexplored in relation to Catholic social teaching and pro-life issues. And I can assure you, there was huge arguments over this particular thing. But I would say, my view is that if somebody refuses, just like a contemporaneous refusal, if somebody refuses, then that has a prima facie, a strong prima facie force on the basis of dignitatis humanae and good, you know, Catholic reasons for accepting autonomy. And that in order to override that, you need the people who are in charge of the common good, that is to say the legitimate authorities, to give you authority to coerce.
But it's, the coercion is, we're having this issue right now in the United States with our hospital, but you could argue the coercion goes the other way. The coercion is towards the Catholic hospital, forcing the Catholic hospital to aim at the death of an innocent
person. But so you think Jehovah's Witnesses should be forced to receive blood?
It depends what they're aiming at, right? Are they aiming at their own deaths? I don't think so.
But a mass refusal doesn't necessarily imply suicidal ideation. Somebody might just think, this is excessive treatment. I don't want this excessive treatment. I don't want to be fussed with this. I want to. I've seen this cause a lot of pain, and so I and other people. So I'm refusing it. You can't. I mean, unless you have good reason, you can't think that the refusal, even a refusal of clinically assisted nutrition hydration, is necessarily a refusal because of a desire to bring about death.
But in my experiment, thought experiment here, which it happens sometimes, so it's not one of those outrageous ones. I can imagine advanced directive which said, if I get into a persistent vegetative state, that is not a life I want to live. Don't feed me. Mm-hmm. In which case, we're coercing the Catholic hospital, and if I'm understanding you correctly, to aim at the death of an innocent person by refusing to feed them.
Which is why I think the law should have such exceptions to allow coercion in the case of suicidal ideation. But if it doesn't, I don't think there's a general right to do so,
okay.
Including the Catholic hospital. And that's kind of the line we talk about.
No, I think we can call it a day there. Join me in thanking the two speakers.